May it please the court. Your honors, good morning. Again, my name is Alexander Cornwell, and I represent appellant Thomas Dennis and appellant Sonia Cherry in their appeal of the trial court's order granting respondents motions to dismiss. This morning, I'd like to address at least two manners in which the trial court erred in denying the entirety of my client's claims. First, contrary to the one and only argument at the trial court level that respondents raised, post-judgment interest, even on non-tort judgments, does not automatically, and more importantly, silently attach to a judgment. And secondly, with respect to my client Tom Dennis in particular, respondents seized hundreds of dollars from his bank account, even assuming they had obtained an award of post-judgment interest. Notably, respondents did not address these additional allegations within their motion to dismiss at the trial court level, and they have continued to ignore them on appeal. Therefore, respondents themselves tacitly concede that this court should reverse the trial court's order with respect to Tom Dennis for this reason alone. Now, I'd like to first turn to the award of post-judgment interest under Section 408.040. And I would ask this court to keep in mind at all times this morning that post-judgment interest is entirely a creature of statute. It did not exist at common law. It is not an inherent entitlement. It's not even viewed as compensation to the creditor. It is simply a statutory tool that the legislature provided creditors to ensure prompt payment of a judgment. However, it is ultimately up to creditors themselves to invoke that statutory remedy. And because it is a creature of statute, the operative standard of review requires us to strictly construe the words under Section 408.040, which state that parties shall be allowed to recover interest on judgments. Now, this court in McGuire versus Conomo rather recently already addressed this precise issue and held in no uncertain terms that the words shall be allowed do not mean that interest is automatic.
Isn't the court referring to a different subsection? It's referring to pre-judgment interest, not post-judgment interest.
Yes, the court was referring to a different subsection of Section 408.040, but the court was referring to post-judgment interest and tort actions, not pre-judgment.
It was post-judgment and tort.
It was.
And it was because of the requirement in the statute that the amount of interest be designated in the judgment, that percentage of interest be designated.
Judge Breckinridge, I believe you actually authored the McGuire opinion, and I'm not at liberty to say what the court intended, but I will just point out a few parts of that opinion, including the fact that this court held on page 661 of the opinion, the trial court did not award post-judgment interest or state an applicable interest rate as prescribed in Section 408.040.
Isn't the post-judgment interest in this case identifiable with the amount without looking to the judgment itself?
If I understand the correct question, in with respect to non-tort actions,
right,
the rate of interest should already be part of the judge or the record and or fixed. So with non-tort actions, if you're suing on a contract, our rules instruct parties that they should attach the instrument upon which they're suing to the record. So that rate of interest, if it's a contract claim, will already be part of the record. In addition, if it's a non-tort non-contract case, it would already be fixed at 9%.
So doesn't that clearly distinguish the cases? In other words, there's no need to establish an amount in a non-tort case because it was already established by contract, or the statute says it's 9%.
I would say that it is not necessary to recite the rate, not necessarily recite the amount. So I would point to the fact that in both tort and non-tort cases, the statute, Section 408.040, breaks it down into two separate clauses. In the first clause, which is the same for both tort and non-tort cases, the statute says that interest, the award of post-judgment interest, shall be allowed. And then in the second clause, all such judgments, i.e. those which are awarded post-judgment interest, shall accrue interest at a rate of 9% for non-tort cases. And then for tort cases, it requires parties to recite the rate given the fact that it is fluctuating at the federal funds rate. And so, again, this court in McGuire held, though the trial court should have included the award of post-judgment interest in the original judgment, it did not, nor nor is there any evidence in the record showing the court's intention to set the interest rate. And therefore, in all actions, tort and non-tort cases, where litigants want to obtain the substantive award of post-judgment interest, they have the obligation to include it on the face of the judgment. And then, for tort cases only, they have the additional obligation to recite the rate at which the award of post-judgment interest will accrue.
Any decision by this court is limited to the facts of that case. Is that not the rule?
I would concede that fact. However, I would also add, Your Honor, that it is impossible to reconcile the assertion that post-judgment interest in non-tort actions automatically and silently attaches with this court's reasoning in McGuire that post-judgment interest is such a substantive change to the judgment that it must be awarded on the judgment. Post-judgment interest does not somehow lose its substantive nature simply because it involves a non-tort action. And likely realizing that fact, respondents have resorted for the first time on appeal to arguing, well, maybe that is the rule of law, however, let's just apply that going forward. And I would submit that respondents have failed to establish even a single one of the three factors that this court enunciated in Sumner's before it will give a decision prospective only effect. First, respondents have not addressed that the court's ruling in McGuire and or this case, but what I'll note is that it is unclear from respondents' arguments whether they're arguing that McGuire should be the decision from which prospectivity applies or whether this court's forthcoming opinion will be that prospective decision. Regardless, respondents have not addressed that either the McGuire decision or this court's decision would be in contrast or inconsistent with clear past precedent. The reasoning behind the clear past precedent consideration is that it's unfair to penalize a party for acting consistently and in conformity with a prior case.
However, that prior case is limited to its facts.
Yes, precisely. And in this case, respondents have argued that they relied upon the 1945 decision of Laughlin. They looked at a single sentence and, in fact, a single clause of dicta in that decision. And their argument to this court is that in relying upon that single clause of dicta, they purposefully and knowingly omitted the award of post-judgment interest on the judgments with respect to Tom Dennis and Sonia Cherry. In actuality, as evidenced by other judgments that these same respondents have taken in non-tort cases, even predating McGuire, they actually customarily do obtain the express award of interest on those judgments. They simply failed to do so with respect to Appellants Dennis and Appellant Cherry. And then, rather than confine their post-judgment collection efforts to the substantive remedies awarded on the judgment, respondents simply decided to extrajudicially, after the fact, add post-judgment interest to their garnishments.
I want to make sure you have time to address your other arguments. If you could do that now.
I will. And so with respect to the second Sumner's factor, we must look at what is consistent with the purpose and effect of judgments as a whole. The reason judgments exist is we can go to four corners of a document and understand the respective rights and obligations of the parties. If this court were to prospectively limit the requirement that post-judgment interest needs to be awarded on the face of the judgment, the retroactive converse is also true. It would be substantively amending the judgments predating its decision. This court would have to write in the award of post-judgment interest where none previously existed. Two judgments that are identical would actually have different substantive remedies imposed simply because they'd be on the different side of an arbitrary deadline. This would create a state of uncertainty for debtors and creditors alike and is antithetical to the reason we have judgments to begin with. I would even submit that it's unclear as to how you would even implement a rule of prospective application. Do we start applying the ruling as of McGuire, November 12, 2014, or this case? Is it that post-judgment interest itself is engrafted on the judgment, or just that we're going to create some judicial exemption of liability?
When did the legislature change the statute regarding post-judgment interest for tort cases?
The legislature amended it in 2005, and it did not amend the language with respect to the award in that first clause. It kept shall be allowed with respect to tort and non-tort cases, and then it added the requirement, in addition to obtaining the award of interest, to also recite the rate at which it's accruing.
Was the shall be allowed language then in effect when prior decisions of the court found that the accrual of post-judgment interest was automatic?
I No, Your Honor, and here's why. I'm not aware of any prior decision that found that post-judgment interest is automatic and silently attaches, absent an award being made. The closest we get, again, is that clause in Laughlin, single clause in Laughlin, that it's unclear as to whether they were even referring to the underlying judgment.
I thought there were old cases that you were critical of because of the date of the cases.
Those cases we were critical of not only because of the date of the cases, but the only issue they addressed is whether you would need to recite the rate of post-judgment interest. I think if you go through the facts, which we endeavored to do in our substitute reply brief, not a single one of those cases on its facts found that absent a substantive award of post-judgment interest, it was permissible to collect it. And again, at most, they're dicta, and that does not rise to the level of prior precedent sufficient to allow us to prospectively apply.
Can you please address your second issue about taking too much from your client, that he only owed, he'd already paid $300 and they only gave him credit for $200?
Yes, Your Honor. So even assuming post-judgment interest was awarded, the undisputed facts demonstrate that my client, Tom Dennis, voluntarily made a payment pursuant to the consent judgment in the amount of $300. And then the respondents failed to credit those payments before seizing at the grocery store he was trying to check out, seizing his money from his bank account. It is undisputed and wasn't even addressed that I'm not aware of any court in the entire nation that has ever found it permissible to actually take money from a consumer that they do not legally owe.
And what would be the legal effect if that is shown, that they took more than they were entitled to and didn't give them credit? What are the legal consequences?
Well, under the FDCPA in particular, any single violation is sufficient to state a claim. Under 1692F1, it is impermissible to collect amounts, including incident to the principal obligation, that are not legally owed. Under 1692E2A, the mere misstatement of an amount, much less the actual taking of those amounts, is unlawful, and so it would violate multiple subsections of the
FDCPA. And are there statutory liquidated damages provisions in effect?
If any single violation, it doesn't matter how many subsections you violate, you are limited to up to $1,000 in statutory penalties as well as actual damages. In this case, the actual damages would include the returning of post-judgment interest that wasn't awarded, as well as the resulting bank fee that Mr. Dennis incurred resulting from the unlawful garnishment.
Before you're seated, I know you filed a motion this week advising the court of the tragic death of Ms. Cherry in an accident and that there has not been substitution of party. Before you're seated, could you address what you're asking the court? We've taken the motion with the case, and tell us what you're asking the court to do.
Candidly, Your Honor, we looked at the procedural rules, and this is a rare circumstance. Ms. Cherry passed away on April 28th. In the manner in which she passed, we have not yet been able to communicate with her family. We would ask if, in the event this court remands the case and reverses the trial court's order, it would be our intention to then file the appropriate substitution at that time. In the alternative, pursuant to the motion to sever that we have filed, if it's this court's preference, we would ask that the court rule on the Dennis case only, and once we are able to determine the correct substitution and the correct entity whom would be substituting, we would then apprise the court of that.
And how much time do you have to file a substitution of parties?
Candidly, again, Your Honor, we are unaware of that procedural rule as it applies to a case on appeal.
But our rules do address it.
We'll research that and file it accordingly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. This particular case, if you adopt the interpretation of 408 section 040.2 as suggested by appellants, you will be reversing essentially over 140 years of case law interpreting a statute that has essentially remained unchanged that entire period of time. And we do not believe that this interpretation is in any way inconsistent with this court's decision in McGuire, which was interpreting a totally separate section of 408.040 and one that had been changed by the legislature to expressly require what this court in McGuire said the lower court judgment had to do.
And so you're answering the question that I asked previously, and that is the shall be allowed language was in effect at the time of those much earlier decisions?
Yes, Judge. We have attached to the appendix all of the statutory provisions that go back. And in fact, it is, if you look more closely at the statute, 408.0402, the appellants only discuss the first clause of that provision. They fail to discuss the second two clauses. The second clause relates to contracts that have interest rates more than 99%. And that clause says it shall, those judgments shall bear interest. No allowable, nothing else in the statute. The second one says the exact same thing, shall bear.
The effect of that, however, when the statutory provision provides that the rate of interest can be that set by agreement of the parties or by statute, could require going beyond the judgment to find out what the rate of interest is? Is that, would that be the effect of interpreting the statute as you suggest?
It is a possibility. However, some of the prior case law we articulated basically made that appropriate. In both the Vogel case and the Catron case, which we talked about, we cited in our brief, both of them expressly stated that if it's unclear, the clerk is to look at the record to make that determination. And generally in these sorts of contract cases, the contract is attached to the agreement, and therefore there's a reference to the to the rate within the contract. If it's not in there or it's lower than that, then they would apply the 9%, which is what the statute allows for.
Under our new rules regarding garnishment, does the initial garnishment go through the clerk?
Yes.
I'm showing my ignorance. So the clerk would have an opportunity to do that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If it's not stated, therefore, they could also review what the attorneys submit. Generally, that's not, I don't know if it's done or not by clerks, but I'm just saying that generally they have the court has the opportunity to review those at that time.
But if the interest rate isn't stated in the judgment and the judgment is tried to be collected upon, isn't it misleading under the federal statute to try to collect on that interest amount that's not even stated on the judgment?
Well, we would disagree that that is a violation of the FDCPA on the grounds that it is clear it's not a communication. There's a number of issues relating to that. But what you would basically be saying is that our following the state law somehow violates the FDCPA. And I'm not so sure that's the requirements of the FDCPA.
But you could easily put that interest rate in the judgment, and then it wouldn't be misleading at all.
It could be put into the judgment. I agree. But that's not what the legislature has provided for here. The legislature has stated very explicitly that they shall bear interest. When the legislature changed the statute in 2005, they made a clear choice. They expressly stated the judgment shall state the applicable interest rate, which will vary once entered.
But that doesn't mean it follows the Federal Debt Collecting Act.
I understand that, but again, Judge, basically we would argue on a number of levels that this is not one. Under the FDCPA, the failure to state a judgment is not a false representation under the FDCPA, as they pled. It's not a communication under the FDCPA, as they pled.
Do you send any communication, or you just send them the judgment? You send nothing in addition to it that says how much is owed?
Pardon, I'm sorry.
Does your client send anything other than a copy of the judgment?
To the, we're not obligated to send a copy of the judgment to it.
So what do you send?
We don't normally send anything other than required by statute. The judgment's entered by the court, we would then try to execute upon the judgment.
And under the rule, the court would send the judgment
correct.
To the party.
Correct.
So how do you execute upon the judgment? You send something to the bank, you send something to, do you send a letter to the bank that says they owe this, or you just send the judgment? I'm trying to find out if there's a communication in addition to a copy of the judgment.
Generally, we might send a communication in an attempt to collect it subsequently, but that's not what it's an issue at this court. The issue at this one is just merely the judgment entered. We would not normally just send that as a matter of it. And when I say it's a judgment, it's not a communication. It's as defined under the FDCPA. Basically, I cited three cases, O'Rourke versus Palisades, Syed versus Wolpork, and Hiverick, all which indicate that basically pleadings and those sorts of judgments are not communications under the FDCPA.
Can you address the particular claim of the second Mr. Dennis that you took, didn't give him credit for the extra $100 and therefore it was?
Judge Myler, I mean, it's our understanding that basically the garnishment as well as the payment were almost simultaneous. As soon as we found out that what happened, we returned the overcharge.
He had already paid before, though. I mean, that you didn't know doesn't give you the right to take more, does it?
Well, again, when you say he had already paid,
it's a strict
the payment liability. Came to our firm, okay. And like I said, they were almost simultaneous.
What were they? What was the difference in time?
I think it was $100, Judge.
You know, I know that. What was the time period?
I think less than a week. Less than a week, Judge, in the matter.
But isn't it a strict liability statute? I mean, you violated it. You owe that money. You didn't respond at all in your appellate brief, which I found concerning.
The reason we didn't respond is because it was at the motion to dismiss stage, Judge, as opposed to the subsequent stage. And we believe that there's other elements under the FDCPA that would preclude his claim, including statute of limitations issue.
But you didn't raise statute of limitations, and the petition specifically alleges that it was filed within the statute of limitations. And aren't we supposed to read the petition as true at this stage?
Well, and I understand that judgment. But we believe that the issue of concerning interest underlying virtually all of their claims. And I will say at oral argument, which I will say I did not attend, it's my understanding the appellants did not raise these other issues. The only focus was on the interest issue. And so...
Well, that doesn't waive anything.
I know it doesn't waive anything, Judge. And it may be inappropriate for a remand for further action as to that particular claim. But I don't believe that it means that basically this court would enter judgment against us on that particular claim at this point in time. I think most it would mean to be remand for further consideration on that claim.
Because a motion to dismiss was granted.
Yes. Proceeding further, again, I just want to emphasize some of the points we made in our brief. In addition to the fact that the shall language applied to contract actions, prior to the change in law in 2005, the same mandatory provision actually applied to tort actions. And we cite especially the Adkins versus Hertz case, which clearly set forth that this particular language is mandatory as to torts action. As to McGuire, as well as the subsequent progeny in the Court of Appeals, SKMDV and Peterson, all of them are tort cases. And they are relying upon subsection 3, which expressly allows that. And the bottom line is, the legislature clearly meant something when it added that language. They clearly were assuming that in the past, at least we can, canons of statutory interpretation are such that different language contained within the same provisions has to have a meaning. And in here, where they expressly required it for tort judgments, but did not expressly require it for non-tort judgments, when they made a minor change to that provision in that same legislation, we have attached to our appendix the bill, the final bill approved by the state legislature, where they make a minor change to that provision, but they don't add the language that the judgment is to state the interest. So clearly the legislature's actions in that must have some meaning, and the meaning must be the prior interpretation of the courts. And I beg to differ that the Laughlin case language is dicta. In that particular case, the issue was whether judgments, which apparently were silent as to the award of interest, of post-judgment interest, as whether it was amount, and the court was making the interpretation, and this is reading straight from the court. The judgment bears interest by reason of the statute, and it is not necessary that it or the mandate recite the fact. That is a line by this court in the Laughlin decision. And therefore, for those reasons, we believe in the Laughlin decision was dealing on a case, as far as we can tell from the record, was completely silent as to the award of post-judgment interest as it is now. Finally, I'd like to get to the issue of prospective effect should this court reverse the decision of the trial court and say that we have to put it through. We did cite the three things in Sumner's, and we believe we easily meet all elements of that three-part test. The first one is must establish a new principle of law by overlooking past precedent. As I've indicated in the Laughlin decision, that is clear language. We've cited a number of cases out of the 1800s, all interpreting the same case. We've cited the Atkins case out of, I believe, 2005, which again applied that to a tort judgment. It's clear this would be a reversal of prior past precedent. The purpose of the new rule, the second part of the Sumner test, is the purpose of the new rule will not be retarded by prospective effect only. Basically, it's the policy decision of the Court of Appeals is that it should be included. If you just make it prospective, basically, judgment debtors will now get the benefit of that, and they can go forward. Judgment creditors will now have understanding this is now a change in the law and therefore can now apply it to, whereas the past they applied what was clearly, from our perspective, the prior law. And finally, the superior hardship falls upon judgment creditors. Both of these decisions were entered prior to this court's even decision in McGuire. Prior to McGuire, and based on the past precedent, we had no clue that the change in statutes as to tort judgments and that interpretation would somehow apply to non-tort judgments. And it's clearly the change in statutory language of that. Furthermore, it would have a various hardship on all creditors and many of their attorneys who relied upon the prior judgments, whereas merely the judgment debtors would be getting that windfall because technically the creditors could have requested that interest and been put into the judgments initially, and the mandatory language gives it. So the judgment debtors would be getting that. And I do want to point out, which one of the things we did in brief, is point out that this similar language is very similar to section 454.520.3 governing judgments involving family court judgments. And that particular one is language shall draw as opposed to shall bear. But the bottom line is, if this is given retroactive effect, judgments involving family court matters, the people, litigants could go back and try to then pull back from parents or spouses' interest on child support and maintenance. And I do not believe that is a result this court would want to have.
Could I interrupt you for a moment? The Court of Appeals found that the only ground you raised in your motion to dismiss was that the law does not require judgments to expressly provide for the collection of post-judgment interest. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Judge, I'm not going to dispute that.
And so in light of that, do you concede then that the trial court erred by dismissing the claim for the collection of, based on the collection of the extra $100?
Judge, because our interpretation of it was that mainly was the interest issue, but if it's just the $100, then I would concede that, yes, Judge.
Well, it's $100 plus $50 plus $1,000.
No, I understand.
It may not be a lot to you, but
right.
Maybe.
No, and I'm not denying that, Judge. I'm not trying to pay fly to that issue, and that's the reason why earlier I said indicating, Judge, if it's proper, it's remand for further consideration, not the entry of a judgment against us on that particular issue.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Your Honors, I would like to focus on a few points, the first of which is all of the case law, the prior case law that respondents are purportedly relying upon, dealt with the omission of the rate, not the omission of the award of interest. We went through each of those cases there were strengths added, but we actually went through the facts of those cases, and every single one of them dealt with the omission of the rate on their facts, not the omission of the substantive award of post-judgment interest to begin with. And if we are going to substantively go back and write in an award of post-judgment interest where none existed, that is arguably unconstitutional. Take, for example, the consent judgment that Tom Dennis entered with respondents. A consent judgment is a form of contract. It would be impossible for us to second-guess whether the parties intended, or perhaps Tom agreed that rather than having post-judgment interest entered against me, I will agree to pay the principal amount of the judgment balance. That is the
well,
only...
Well, doesn't that... The question is, they're saying the statute provides automatically for interest, and so that's subsumed in it unless you say otherwise. You would.
Well,
and, your client is presumed to know the law.
And as to that point, the statement was made that all such judgments shall bear interest. I think they're attaching their interpretation on that second clause. But again, the first clause is interest shall be allowed. Then all of those where it has been awarded, where it has been allowed, shall bear interest. And so they're ignoring the first clause that this court in McGuire already said that the words shall be allowed mean you get it if you ask for it, but it is a substantive change to the judgment and is not the court's place to go back and write in a substantive remedy.
Can you address the reliance of creditors on prior case law interpreting that to mean that you get it automatically?
I certainly can, and I would go no further than the judgments in the record that respondents themselves obtained prior to McGuire in non-tort actions. The record has examples of them obtaining the express award of post-judgment interest. Quite simply, they know how to do it right. They simply neglected to do so with respect to Tom Dennis and Sonia Cherry.
Can you address how can an order of the court be a communication of your their communication? It's the court's order, not theirs.
Certainly. Under 1692E, which deals with the definition of communication, it is the direct or indirect dissemination of information to a consumer.
But there is a connection between the dissemination of information and the party.
Correct, but it's direct or indirect. And as Judge Breckenridge, you noted that a default judgment is sent to the consumer. A consent judgment is a direct negotiation where both parties actually sign the communication. We provided case law in our briefing that actually provided, which negated a respondent's argument that pleadings are not a communication. That is a well-settled rule that pleadings, including a judgment, fits the definition of a broad definition of a communication.
So you can be liable for forwarding a court's judgment? Is there a case that's really said that?
If the judgment itself is a communication that is drafted and prepared.
You're begging the question. Has any case said that you can be liable for a false communication if you forward a judgment entered by the court?
If you obtain a judgment entered by the court, I believe Moss versus Barton is a case that we cited in our briefing that said failure to disclose interest on a judgment is in fact a communication that is subject to the FDCPA.
I understand, but forwarding the, I mean, if you said this is all you owe and you forwarded a judgment, then you're adding a communication to that. Was something forwarded to your client that said this is all you owe or this is the amount or what is it you're saying was the communication?
Yes, Your Honor. May I
answer
the question? So there's two different communications here. First, Tom Dennis is a consent judgment. It is a direct communication and is a reduction of the party's agreement. Then, with respect to the default judgment, it was prepared, entered, and drafted by the respondents and then mailed to Ms. Cherry. The communication there is the indirect
and
dissemination.
Who mailed it? The court mailed the judgment?
Correct.
After so the court did
excuse
it?
Me. Yes, Your Honor. After it was prepared, drafted, and entered and requested by the respondents.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.